In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokhan, Mira Salganik, and Ekaterina Kudashkina invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We're joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists, and experts sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative, but above all, fair.
Yes, Mira, and this week we would obviously start with another Middle East storm, the most disastrous and life-taking, which hit Libya. Then we would see how opposition acts in Russia, discussing its recent political manifesto published in Western media. And finally, we would end with discussing a new twist in the history of Kosovo independence with millionaire Bedřich Pakoli's scandalous election of Kosovo's president.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm afraid I can't take my mind off Libya.
Of course, Mira, so do I, and so let us start with it. And this is event of the year, I guess, overshadowing Tunisia and Egypt.
And it will have a long-time ramifications in future tours, you know.
So let's come to beyond the headlines. This is Red Line's first heading in which we shall speak about events in Libya and Libya's long-time leader Muammar Gaddafi. And, Mira, I can't resist the temptation to open it with a well-known phrase, which is revolutions used to eat up their offspring.
Indeed. You remember who said it?
Who?
It was one of the leaders of French Revolution, Danton.
Who was sentenced to death, by the way.
Well, he uttered this phrase, actually, minutes before his beheading.
By his former comrades.
As always. As usual in revolutions. Oh, I see. You want to compare him to Gaddafi, don't you?
Well, Mira, in a way, of course, I can compare him to Gaddafi. I think that what we are witnessing now in Libya is another twist of history, and Muammar Gaddafi has been faced with a new breed of revolutionaries who finally came for his head. And this was the case with Danton also.
Oh, well, I mean, all comparisons of this kind are, should I say, slippery. Anyway, what we have in mind, you and me, that his hasty appearance on Libyan TV, I mean, just 22 seconds, though the nation was used to much longer speeches. I mean, it was the shortest in all his 42 years of rule, but that doesn't matter. Well, it did look like a goodbye to the nation and goodbye to everything. You remember he appeared under heavy rain, clutching this grey umbrella. It was a highly dramatic appearance. But
you're referring just to his first appearance on TV. And that same day later, he came up with a second address.
The nation didn't have the time to recover.
In which he lashed out at his opponents and made himself clear that he would not step down. And finally, yesterday, can you imagine? He again appeared on TV and compared himself to, guess whom? To Queen Elizabeth.
Well, I could really forgive him to Queen Elizabeth. I don't know whether she would. But look, how did you like the resurrection of Osama bin Laden, who is, according to Gaddafi, responsible for the whole turmoil there?
Well,
you want to put it in chronological order. Okay.
But coming back to his TV address, because this is fairly important, so I want to quote what struck me most of all. So here is what Gaddafi said. I'm in Tripoli and not in Venezuela. Do not believe the channels belonging to stray dogs. And in fact, it was the main message he could deliver after days of protests. But I think that though he tries to look defiant these days, to me it is obviously that the game is almost over and the country is sliding into chaos.
But then, Sergei, there is another, I'd say, interesting point. These protests, which you claim have sent the country into chaos, it is sending it, but it does send. But it seems to have united almost everyone. I mean, look at least at the TV picture. That's what we can see. Men in the street. Yes, religious, tribal leaders, army and police officers in Tripoli and Benghazi, and finally, Libyan diplomats in New York and elsewhere. On the one hand, there is a kind of unity of heterogeneous elements in this movement. Doesn't it strike you? On the other hand, there is a division, one hears about it all the time, into clans, into tribes.
Well, we still see his supporters with green banners, and we see those messenger is armed to teeth those cutthroats who are hunting for their position. But at the same time, I can agree that what we are witnessing now is a revolt never seen in Libya's post-colonial history. And Gaddafi's resort to violence in a desperate attempt to crush the new Libyan revolution with iron fist can only add to the agony of his regime, I think, but not save it, you know?
Well, look, to me one thing by now is crystal clear. Libya has already passed the point of no return.
Ah, that's true, of course. That's
whatever true. Happens... Whatever regiments he might be, Gaddafi might sort of, you know, call for his defense or other things, there is no return to what has been. This is quite clear. Now, the question is, what comes next? How the hell does Gaddafi still expect to continue to rule this land soaked with blood and piled with corpses after what he has done?
Well, his sons are still talking about his new position in New Libya after drastic political reforms which they promised the people, but I don't think this can ever work, you see. And this question you are asking is just a rhetoric question, I think, Mira.
It is rhetoric, of course.
And the new Middle East revolution, already the third one in less than just 2 months after Tunisia and Egypt, has already become the most life-taking, you see. And Presidents Ben Ali and Mubarak, whom we discuss here in our previous Red Lines issues, no matter how corrupt and autocratic their regimes were, at least they refrain from shooting and bombing their own people, as Colonel Gaddafi is doing without hesitation these days, Mira.
You know, thinking about it, I couldn't but compare Gaddafi to, say, Ben Ali or Mubarak. All right, so Ben Ali fled, end item. Mubarak did behave like, in a manly manner, in a wise manner. Whatever. Now, Gaddafi, I mean, who called him the mad dog of the Middle East?
That was Ronald Reagan, by the way.
Well, I mean, Ronald Reagan is not my favorite, but in this, I wholly, totally side with his estimation. He does act like a mad dog. Not Reagan, Gaddafi.
But you know, Mira, on the other hand, this time I don't want to make too much parallels between the Tunisian, Egyptian and Libyan scenarios. Although all three of them, to my mind, vividly demonstrate a new phenomenon, signs of a new, I would call it, pan-Arab identity, because for the first time in the post-colonial history, Arab nations are rising not against the United States, not against Israel, as it used to be for decades during the Cold War time, but now against political stagnation and social injustice in their own countries.
I think that you have made a most important point now, and I fully agree with you. This is the difference of those revolutions from what has been going on before, because, I mean, there were other things too. And I would rather take a closer look at the peculiarities of Libyan revolution, of Colonel Gaddafi, as it stands by itself in the Arab world, don't you think so?
Are you referring to 96 coup, which brought Gaddafi to power?
Well, we could start with this. We ought to start with this.
But then it's just another line in the list of great utopias of the 20th century, from Cuba to North Korea, that were posing themselves as viable alternative to the liberal democracies of the West, which were proclaiming themselves democracies of new type, in place of, so to say, rotten liberalism of Europe and imperialism and neocolonialism of America.
Well, yes, but, Sergei, I don't think it's all that simple.
There are other factors, too. It's not that simple, of course, Mira, but one of the most breathtaking books I've ever read was this famous Green Book by Muammar Gaddafi. And maybe you don't know that, but thanks to the efforts of his Russian admirers, it was published in Russian several years ago in, you know how many copies?
Nine.
100,000 copies.
And this is
the number of modern Russian author could hardly dream of, as you understand.
Of course. Now, you have read the book. I have seen it, but I didn't read it. And did you enjoy it?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it was so enjoyable that at times I was falling under the spell of Gaddafi's powerful aphoristic style, and it was reminding me of my school days reading Nietzsche and Schopenhauer. And in his book, Gaddafi explained the ABC of the unique nature of Libyan Jamahiriya, which came into being after the 1969 revolution, which has overthrown Libyan monarchy.
So now we're coming to it.
Listen, Mira, according to this theory, Libya is the most democratic state in the world, self-governed by revolutionary committees, grassroots bodies which are much more effective than regular municipal bodies of the West. And Gaddafi's smart pen also explained that democracy of new type doesn't need a constitution, which he viewed as usurpation of Western rotten democracy.
Western rotten democracy, the good old rhetoric.
Well, he always criticized it, didn't he? Just listen how Gaddafi explained the limitations of Western democracy. I've prepared some quotes, you know, I translated into English from Russian, but I hope it is accurate enough. So let me quote from the Green Book again. Just listen. A referendum is a falsification of democracy. Those who say yes and no don't express their will. Modern democracy dooms them to silence, as the only words they're allowed to say are yes or no. So, referendum is the most ruthless form of dictatorial rule. And here is another quote about sports. Just listen. Boxing and wrestling reveal that mankind is not yet civilized enough to be able to overcome atavisms of barbarity. However, once the civilization moves up on the ladder of evolution, this barbarity would go.
Oh, yes, indeed. These days, we are certainly admiring the real value of his sophisticated intellectual exercises on boxing and wrestling. Libyan is being bombed.
That bloody bomb that's in
it.
Wrestling.
That's it. That means it's sliding down the, how did he say, ladder of civilization. Mm. Oh, gosh.
So he's showing how civilized he is, you know.
Indeed.
While bombing warplanes, you know.
Indeed. On masses of lives cost.
Death toll is rising to hundreds.
No, thousands now.
Thousands already, yeah. And this is the real moment of truth for Libyan democracy of new type, so-called democracy.
You may say so, of course.
So, all in all, I think that there's every reason to believe that a man who wanted to outwit all philosophers, political and public thinkers of all ages, has been merely suffering from paranoia. And I believe his example bears universal meaning. It shows how all so-called democracies of new type, whether it is Iranian Islamic democracy or North Korean Chuche democracy,
yes.
Some other Nigeria democracy or Cuban democracy, would finally end, you know?
Well, I won't argue that. Surely not. I agree.
And now let us hear the voice from the region. Now we are joined by Mohamed Beysat, Deputy Chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of Polisario. Ekaterina Kudashkina spoke to him.
What's happening in Libya is unacceptable.
Of course.
It is totally unacceptable, it's condemnable, and it's lamentable. This is a people. They have the right to demonstrate. They have the right to speak. They have the right to express their views. And I'm very saddened. I'm right now watching the news, and I'm very saddened with what happened.
I have seen strange reports that Al-Qaeda is allegedly claiming it's taking over in Libya. How realistic is that?
That's rubbish.
I thought so.
That is rubbish, totally rubbish. This is a people who want to live in peace, in harmony. This is a people who want to take the command of his country and of his destiny. And that's the argument for many years. Anyone who wants to change, he will be labeled and blamed to be from this and from that.
But is there any news coming in concerning Muammar Gaddafi?
You was hearing him speaking by phone to Libyan television about Zawiya, a city in the west of Libya. And he was almost repeating what he was saying earlier.
That he was prepared to become a martyr in Libya?
Something like that, yes.
But isn't it strange? Because do I get it right that some 40 years ago, he was a popular leader, wasn't he? So what happened to him over time?
He was a pan-Arabist. Started in 79 as a pan-Arabist nationalist. It was something like the extension of the phenomenon of Nasser in Egypt. Then in 77, he declared what he called the rule of masses and changed the country to Jamahiriya.
What's that?
His theory that he wrote in his Green Book and all that started in 77. changed the name, the flag, everything about Libya, and he changed it himself also, which is continues till now with different meanings than after 86 when he was bombarded by Reagan administration. He became very paranoid and very, it's impacted on him very strongly. Then it was a decade of isolation and so on till
2003.
Till 2003, actually, yes. Then after 2003, he was rehabilitated to the international community and he was claiming to be the leader of the African Union and so on. But also that was a fiasco and a total failure. But whatever the development of this phenomenon, he has no right whatsoever to treat the people of Libya to this situation. And
so of course he has no right to do that. Of course he has no right
terrible.
To shoot his own people.
This is terrible. This is very sad. And
but like you said, I don't think that it is actually a figure of speech, but he does seem to have paranoia to an extent. I mean, he
not
does
sure
seem to be
about his mental health, actually. He's not sure that he is right.
What is going to follow? Because as far as I understand, his son is not popular either.
His sons, because which son you are speaking about, he has
the one who made a speech.
Safe.
Yes, that's it.
No, that's he has nothing. He has no legitimacy. I was surprised that he speaks to the people. Who is he? He's not in the government. He's not an elected. He was not from the officers who did coup d'etat. Who is he? How he gave himself the authority to speak to the people?
Mm-hmm. But what
there
about his other sons?
All of them the same.
But does that mean that it is an end to Gaddafi rule, either it is father
it's
or
an
any
end.
Of the sons?
It's and what's happening in Libya is the end of a regime, beginning of another regime. This is actually a very sad state of affairs, and it's taken too long to be finished, and it's terrible, actually. It's lamentable. It's very sad.
But does the opposition have anyone to name as successor?
Anything that comes will be better than this guy. Anything. No matter what is this thing, will be far better off.
Do you think it is a rather of a universal phenomenon, like people who has remained in power for so long, they tend to develop into some kind of monsters?
This is a unique case of study. This is
in which
situation.
Way?
Unique is a guy who is not well in his mind, who is ruling, shooting his people, killing them, who has no constitution, who has no laws, who state of anarchy. He behaves like a gangster. I'm very
That's
sorry
right.
to say the word, but this is, I don't remember a case, at least in the modern history of humanity, that matches this phenomenon.
That's right. But still he's been in his place for more than 40 years.
Yes, you know, you say Ben Ali has a constitution, some sort of party, some masquerade. Mubarak has the same. He was somehow, there are people with him. There is a constitution, there is law, there is parliament, sort of. This is has nothing of that. This is one-man show.
That's right.
Who rule with his desires and change it as he wants, or say whatever he wants.
That's right.
Help himself.
Well, do you think that he's going to become another martyr? Is he going to be killed?
I will not use martyr for this kind of phenomena. The Libyans will finish him. I'm very sure he will not live. I'm sure he has no right, he has no ability to see the reality. As it is, he's incapable of understanding. He has lost any touch with the reality on the ground. He will be there till he die. And it's not very far away, that situation. Someone of his aides will finish him.
Right. Well, that's the end of a dictator.
Mm-hmm.
What else can we say? Is that right?
Nothing.
Well, Mr. Besart, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
And now welcome to the Red Line second heading, Between the Lines, in which we usually discuss the most interesting articles of the week. Yet this time I suggest we could take up a piece which I would describe rather as notable, not just interesting. And I'm referring to a story called No More Western Hugs for Russian Rulers, run by the Washington Post. It is written by four leaders of a Russian opposition party known as staunch critics of President Medvedev, Prime Minister Putin, Russia's ruling duo.
Well, so as I understand, this is not just an article, but some sort of a new political manifesto.
We may call it, it's an article, but we may call it a manifesto.
It looks like a manifesto, and since I'm sick and tired of reading articles, I thought that once in a while it would be interesting to read a manifesto and now to discuss it. But shouldn't we say a few words about the authors first?
I think we have to make a brief introduction for our audience.
It.
But like I said, there are four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Mikhail Kasyanov, Vladimir Milov, Boris Nemtsov, and Vladimir Ryshko. And they positioned themselves as co-chairs of the People's Freedom Party of Russia.
Well, to be very frank, I didn't hear much about this party. However, all the names, of course, are familiar. We have been living with them for a while.
In fact, none of them is a newcomer to Russian politics. And as you remember, Mira, Mikhail Kasyanov served as finance minister under President Yeltsin's time. Then he was a prime minister under President Putin and joined opposition after resigning from the cabinet. And Boris Nemtsov was a vice premier during Boris Yeltsin, and at one point he was even considered to become Yeltsin's successor.
Well, what I remember well, and I don't think you've forgotten it, he had conceived that bright idea that all the top bureaucracies should drive only in homemade cars.
Volga, top of the line Volga cars.
That's right. This is what I remember. Very constructive it was, wasn't it? And now...
But he's on the other side of the barricades now.
That's it. And he is a regular participant of street opposition meetings, rallies too.
Well, but such things do happen in politics, not only in Russia. And so another author is Vladimir Milov, who at one time was a cabinet member also. And finally, Vladimir Ryshko. He was not in the government actually, but he is also an old bird in Russian politics, and he was MP for some time.
Well, all the names are familiar, are telling for the Russian liberal audience, but what is the point they're making now? Because they are not now writing for Russian audience. The Washington Post is not widely read in Russian streets.
Well, the large part of the article, as could be expected, is devoted to the harsh criticism of top Russian leadership. And the idea of the story is that Russia's economy and political system desperately need comprehensive modernization, but authors believe that Putin-Medvedev duo is a major obstacle to it. And they also write a lot about it, as they put it, corrupt practices by the Russian establishment whose ability to find havens for stolen funds and leave Russia for comfortable lives in Western nations is one of the regime's pillars of stability. This is the quote.
Well, it's too long-winded for my taste. Anyway, one may agree or disagree with their statement, but isn't it their right to assess things as they do? But my question is, what do they propose as their opposition? Do they have and do they spell a coherent alternative program if the present one
not really.
Is not like
that? I didn't find it in the article, and this is my main objection. There's no program as such, let alone a coherent one, I would say. And the article is short on substance when one comes to analyze it. The story of more than 5,000 characters doesn't contain even a hint to relevant description of their program.
However, it ends up with what I would think amounts to a solemn oath. If you give me a chance to quote from the manifesto too, now I'm quoting, "We are sure that we can achieve our goals through freedom and normal democratic process, provided we get these restored in our country." Did they make it clear? Does it mean that they are ready to restore it, or do you want to get it ready-made?
No indication of it. And instead of that, they are blaming the West for, as they put it, undermining their case and compromising the very principles Western society is based upon. And you know, Mira, there's another thing I noticed in this article. I think the story in itself has another distinctive feature which makes it different from regular Russian opposition jabs on Putin.
What's that?
Well, the article contains targeted criticism of President Medvedev, the most harsh ever made till now. As for some time, as you know, Russian liberal opposition was making some stakes on Medvedev's modernization drive and refrained from attacking the president, trying to hobnob him. So this is not the case anymore. They also attacked Medvedev. They disillusioned him.
You see, this article is a kind of a watershed. The authors blame Medvedev for pro-democracy rhetoric, but not turning it into real action. That's okay. And they believe that Medvedev has invested almost personally in the plethora of misdeeds.
But this is another quote, isn't it?
This is another quote. They are also
so I think too much of quotes, Mira, now. So let me tell you just what I think of it. The manifesto in itself evokes mixed feelings. I think the authors are right in exposing the perils of Russia's corruption. And it is an open secret that Russia is an utterly corrupted state, at least to me, you know, and that corruption is a serious threat to its very existence, not to mention modernization. But I can't buy the notion that Medvedev is not fighting with corruption. This is not true, Mira. We shall say this openly now.
Yes, I agree, and let me add to it. The publication of the story coincided...
We can prove it, yes, by the facts.
That's not difficult. I mean, if you go on proving it with the facts, you cannot produce perhaps enough results, but the process is going on, there is no doubt. But look, the publication of the story did coincide with a series of high-profile dismissals from offices at the top echelons of Russian power. It is the anti-corruption drive this week itself that President Medvedev sacked. Can you imagine? The Prosecutor General of Moscow District and Deputy Head of Russia's powerful, all-powerful Federal Security Service, the successor of KGB, you may call it.
So he was also sacked. And don't you find that very resolve the opposition wanted to see from President Medvedev? So I personally don't understand the logic of attacking him at this particular point. It looks irrelevant to me. I think that they simply missed the point.
Well, look, if opposition doesn't like the leadership, it should at least make an attempt to take the power.
That's true.
In any country.
Not only
everywhere.
In Russia.
Of course, not only. Russia is no exception. Either through the election power or through the revolutions, which I hope won't occur in Russia enough for us. But we see what is going on in the Middle East. Real opposition has to have guts. And what I detest, I'm sorry that I'm using strong language, but I do detest the opposition's appeal to the West to stop hugging Putin and do what? Get ready to hug them instead? The opposition? It is a fact that this kind of opposition does not have an election base in Russia. It's a fact. Even the section not willing to vote for the ruling duo is ready to vote for them? No. This being so, how, for God's sake, would their appeal to the West help them? This is what I want to know.
And they're calling to cease greetings Russian rulers as equals and even to impose sanctions. But this is not the way.
Well, of course not. They should make their message loud and clear to be heard by the masses. They should contest and win the election. There is simply no other way.
They should be ready to take power to show that they have guts and verve and zest.
There is just no other way. But it seems that they prefer to assure the West that the next round of election is going to be rigged.
So they want the West to do the job for them?
Well, I mean, it doesn't even have to be discussed because the West is not going to
do the job for them. It only indicates a low morale of Russian liberal opposition, which
is deeply
regrettable to me as a liberally minded person, Mira.
I'm not an orthodox either.
But we in this country definitely need opposition. As we are not Middle East type of regime, and we want politics to have a different foundation, not like in Egypt or Libya, which we discussed.
Or Libya, for God's sake.
And now I suggest we listen to an interview with Dr. Ariel Cohen, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. He was interviewed by Ekaterina Kudashkina.
Dr. Cohen, thank you very much for joining us. As far as I understand, you also read the story. And first, I just want to make it clear. The authors are saying that kisses and hugs, real politics, the way they put it, has failed. Is that correct? And what could they imply?
There is election campaign coming up this year for the Duma and the presidential campaign next year. And the four leaders of the democratic opposition, the Party of People's Freedom, believe, and I think they have base to believe, that their party is not going to be treated very well in these election campaigns. We just heard from Mikhail Gorbachev that he said that his candidacy is not going to be allowed to be registered for presidential elections. And the Democrats think that the rapprochement that we have between the West and Russia, the reset policy and policy of the European countries, allow to discriminate against opposition, including their party, in the election cycle that Russia is going through.
So what could the West do in this situation?
What the authors of the article in the Washington Post suggest is that the West balances, at least, its pursuit of business opportunities and strategic cooperation like arms control in Afghanistan and Iran cooperation with a stricter position on Russian democracy, human rights, etc., etc. They specifically are talking about the Khodorkovsky trial, the Magnitsky death in jail, and about access to television and other issues that even President Medvedev talks about, like police corruption or abuse of the court system. So there is an overlap in this agenda between, I would say, President Medvedev and the Democratic opposition. And I think it's in Russian interest to allow Democratic opposition to be in the Duma and to have a viable candidate for the Democratic opposition in the presidential elections of 2012, provided the Democrats would agree on one such viable candidate. So far, they demonstrated that they don't agree on such a candidate.
I agree with you, but they also say that Western nations could introduce targeted sanctions against the officials. So do you think that a sanction regime could really work?
We did not have a sanction regime against Russian officials, and we're talking about specific people who commit specific violations, such as allowing Magnitsky to die without medical care in jail. But there are other countries against which targeted sanctions were applied or are applied, such as Belarus and Iran, maybe some other countries. So I do not know, I cannot tell you whether it's going to be effective or not, because this was never tried. But I'll add one more thing. This is not the idea of Kasyanov, Milov, Ryzhkov, and Nemtsov. These ideas have appeared in the U.S. Congress, in the European Parliament, and in the European Commission. So we should not point fingers at these four leaders, these four politicians, saying, oh, they're calling to impose sanctions against their own country, against the officials of their own country. No. There are politicians in the West who are advocating such sanctions.
Like you said, Mr. Medvedev too speaks about fighting corruption. Well, he talks about different problems which we are aware of and which we're encountering. But as far as I understand, it's a long job and it's a difficult job. But what do you think perhaps members of that party could suggest to be more efficient in fighting corruption? Just to some more efficient
ways?
Well,
clearly, law enforcement officials should not take bribes, should not take protection money from casinos, as we just found out in Moscow region, where some policemen, some bad apples in police, were protecting, quote-unquote, some underground casinos. So in order to fight that, you probably have to do what several countries in Eastern Europe have done before, and that is look for new people, give them good salaries, the previous contingent, hire the new contingent, and if anybody is caught taking bribes or providing undue services, these people not only should lose their jobs, they should lose their freedom. They should go to jail for corruption. And the second thing is, it's not just a traffic policeman, a gaishnik, you know, the guy in the street who stops your car for being dirty or not having a little light blinking or something like that. It should be generals, it should be ministers and deputy ministers in this law enforcement vertical, in this law enforcement structure. Only then, when there is a fear of God in these people that they won't violate their sacred duty to protect their people, only then corruption struggle is going to be efficient and effective. And clearly, when generals own airplanes or when they own multimillion-dollar villas and dachas and drive in very expensive foreign cars, that should be a subject for investigation of the source of their income. And if there is even a suspicion of taking bribes or receiving money from businesses that they provide security services or protection services, these people have to be punished and kicked out of their jobs.
And it reminds me just a little bit of the Chinese know-how in fighting corruption.
And even the Chinese, a lot of problems, and there is a pervasive problem of corruption in China. So the Chinese are probably not a good model because the Chinese don't have free press. Free press is very important in fighting corruption because this is who digs up this information. This is who publishes it. This is very important to have, and the freedom of the press has to be protected by the Duma, by the executive branch, and by the courts. The journalists should not be attacked, should not be touched. If they're digging up dirt on corrupt officials, this is also their sacred duty. But media will not achieve what law enforcement and courts have to achieve, which is have people who violated the law and give them punishment that they deserve.
What do you think would be the best conditions to implement that splendid program? I mean, those are people who have already been in power. I think that at the time, an issue of corruption was as acute as now, or perhaps a little bit,
according to international statistics, Transparency International and others, actually the situation in the last 10 years has deteriorated, and there is something going wrong. And also, Kasyanov was prime minister, but even prime minister in Russia doesn't control the law enforcement. It's the job of the president. So I will not say that Kasyanov, and definitely not Nemtsov, Milov, and Ryzhkov were in positions were themselves fighting corruption. I'll remind our listeners that Nemtsov at some point suggested that the Russian officials would drive only Russian-made cars, the Volgas, and he was laughed at, and it did not go anywhere. The Russian senior officials are still driving expensive foreign cars.
There's a reason to that, because the price for Volga is almost the same as the price for mid-priced foreign car.
Okay.
That argument, it does not mean that driving Volga is not driving an expensive car. So to sum up,
I think that politicians who fight for political power, who feel that they don't have equal access to the media and the system is stacked against them, appeal to foreign media, appeal to foreign countries, because they feel like the dissidents felt in the Soviet era, that there's too much pressure from the authorities. And in view of what happened in the Middle East, I think the lessons should be not more crackdown, but less crackdown, less efforts to keep down the opposition, and more effort to bring the democratic opposition that is in favor of modernization and integration of Russia into the global economy, that is not ultra-nationalist, that is not communist. There is more need for the ruling party, the United Russia, Единая Россия, to cooperate with these people.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Cohen.
Thank you.
Mira, I was quite impressed by what Dr. Cohen said. I think he was convincing enough, and he showed balanced approach, which is very difficult because those are very politically highly charged issues, as you understand.
Well, yes, I agree, and I thought it was a very interesting exposé he presented, indeed.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
And now we are turning to Red Line's concluding heading man in the news. This time, the man of the week is Bajet Pakoli, the newly elected president of Kosovo, whose nomination, approved by Kosovo Parliament this Tuesday, turned into a fresh scandal as opposition accused him of buying votes to get a key post. Millennia-turned-president Bajet Pakoli is a much-spoken figure in Russia, as his Swiss-based construction firm refurbished the Kremlin in the late 90s. But he's also much-spoken in Balkans and Europe, and so does Kosovo, the much-contested land, the name of which has been for the last decade evoking tragic associations of constant turmoil and bloodshed.
Kosovo, which at one point, turned into a major bone of contention in Russia's relations with the West, as Russia opposed its independence.
Exactly, and it is an open secret that Mr. Pakoli is viewed with suspicion by many Kosovars due to his close links to Russia I was referring to, and who is coming to head Kosovo 3 years after it proclaimed its independence.
Before we go any longer, just to remind our listeners, Kosovo's 2008 Declaration of Independence had been recognized by 75 countries, with 5 of the European Union's 27 members still refraining from recognizing it. However, Serbia has pledged to revert the secessionist move. Russia, siding with Serbia, firmly opposed Kosovo's independence.
Russia reiterated time and again that her position remains unchangeable.
You know, Sergei, once I was interviewing Arkady Volsky, Russian and prominent political figure of Gorbachev and Yeltsin era. You must remember him, Sergei.
I remember Volsky, yeah.
And he has been at that time the sort of a go-between Azerbaijan and Armenia, trying to settle the Karabakh problem. Well, anyway, speaking about the explosiveness of issues of this type, Arkady Ivanovich has brought in Kosovo, too.
So it was already 20 years back? So more than 20 years back, yeah?
About 20 years back. Well,
but interesting, what did he say?
He said a very interesting thing, I'd say. He said that it all began with ethnic cleansing in former Yugoslavia when Kosovars were forcibly relocated to Kosovo. I vividly remember his saying that it was tantamount to planting a powerful landmine, which is bound to explode sooner or later. Well, it did explode, and we are still witnessing its ramifications.
Whatever it was, Kosovo's problem is there. And Russian media is reporting Mr. Pakoli's election in details, probably giving it more prominence than others, which are almost exclusively preoccupied these days with Midi's Jasmine revolutions.
Now so richly splattered with Libyan blood. But another reason is that the name of Budget Pakoli, as you have mentioned, Sergei, rings a loud bell here. It is true that Russia's Kosovo newly elected president is known to be a central figure of a Kremlin reconstruction refurbishing scandal that involved a number of people close to former President Boris Yeltsin. That high.
And Moscow-based Daily Kommersant reminds that Pakoli, now the new Kosovo alliance leader, came to Russia in early 90s when his Switzerland-based company Mabitex Group was commissioned first to carry out projects in the Republic of Yakutia.
And Yakutia, which is rich in precious gems, as you know, was a gem for our hero, because there he made friends with Pavel Borodin, who in 1993 became the head of the presidential property management department. And soon after this appointment, Pakoli's firm was hired to reconstruct the Kremlin, Shuiskaya Chupa, whatever it means. It's the name of a presidential residence, government headquarters of State Duma, and whatnot. I am referring to Pavel Borodin, who now is the State Secretary of Belarus and Russia Union.
Mira, imagine, I have seen his book, and it is called The Grand Kremlin Palace After Reconstruction and Restoration.
He should be familiar at least with one aspect of the process.
The financial one, you mean?
Of course.
In 1996, Mabitex's office in Lugano was searched at Russia's request, and Pakoli was questioned by then-Swiss state prosecutor Carla Del Ponte. Later on, it was she who accused Hashim Tachi of trafficking in human organs. Though the charges are still not proved, they successfully destroyed Tachi's reputation worldwide.
But finally, Pakoli's scandal did end, or didn't it?
You may say it did. Swiss authorities charged Pakoli with money laundering and giving huge bribes. But the proceedings in Russia were dismissed in December 2000 and Switzerland closed the case in March 2002. Now he emerges as president of Kosovo, a head of state that is to discuss international problems in Brussels, Washington, Belgrade, and even in Moscow. Still, I'd say Pakoli looks like an angel compared to Hashim Tachi.
Well, I'm afraid I don't know enough about angels, but to me it seems to be the difference between the two, Tachi and Pakoli. It's the difference between light black and dark black.
Well, since I am not good at distinguishing the shades of black, I suggest we speak instead of the recent parliamentary election in Kosovo, which paved Pakoli's way to presidency and to international politics too.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the election is not very recent. It took place in last December, December the 12th, right? And it was Hashim Tachi's Democratic Party that got the majority of votes, but only enough to 34 parliamentary seats out of 120, with none of the major parties willing to join Tachi's in coalition, Well, that left Hacha with pretty little space for maneuver, right?
And let me add to it. Pakoli's new Kosovo alliance came fifth in the election, but Pakoli, described as the richest Albanian in the world, was ready to join hands with Hashim Thaçi on the conditions that he becomes president.
Yes, and he made a very grandiloquent public announcement when he said that I see no reason why I'm not elected the president. Well, there is an important point that I wanted to make. In Kosovo, president is elected by parliament, as we learned, and it is the ruling party or coalition that nominates the candidate. It must be remembered that though president has less power than the prime minister, he is by no means a ceremonial figure. Moreover, according to the Albanian media, Pakoli and Thaçi agreed that new Kosovo alliance, that is Pakoli's party, will appoint one deputy prime minister, four ministers, whose portfolios are not yet clear, but four of them.
Whereas the Serbian parties will have three ministers. The other minorities will divide two posts, of a minister and of a deputy prime minister. However, neither the president of Kosovo nor its prime minister could hope to gain a position of respect in world politics, alas. Pakoli could be the richest Albanian in the world, but his scandalous exploits in Russia would hardly be forgotten.
And Hashim Thaçi's standing has been undermined by a recent Council of Europe report making all sorts of lurid allegations against him. The ULEX, the European Union police mission in Kosovo, is now investigating again. Poor Kosovo, Sergei.
At any rate, Mira, now that the Kosovo does have a government more than 2 months after the election, Brussels can start working on its long-cherished project of a dialogue between Belgrade and Pristina. But let us finally hear the voice from Balkans. Now we are joined by Ivan Zvonimir Šišak, chairman of the Croatian Committee for Human Rights. Ekaterina Kudashkina spoke to him.
Mr. Pakoli, who seems to be the new president of Kosovo.
Yes.
First of all, it's very strange the way he was elected, because as far as I understand, he was the only candidate running for president?
Well, that's normally in the ex-communist countries that you have only one candidate.
But he was elected only in the third round.
In the parliament, yes. It's a lot of doubt about him because, you know, you have some sort of accusations that he is corrupted and it's a sort of political corruption. Then you have a very strong accusation against Hashim Thaçi because of the human bodies and that transportation, you know, black market of drug and prostitution and so on. So it's a lot of accusation about corruption in this country. And especially about him. It's the sort of agreement, a deal between, it could be explained like a deal between the different mafia clans. Well, I think they're trying to find somebody who is looking European. It means who is living out of the country, mm-hmm. like the Golic, who lived in Italy and in Croatia, everywhere else. Russia, because he made the restoration of Kreml. So, you know, he has an image of a European man, what they need. But the problem is that after that scandal which you have with our Premier Sanader, who was arrested, as you know, in Austria for the corruption, European institutions are very careful about Balkans and about corruption. So I don't know how it will be seen in European circles did that election.
Does that mean that people who support the corrupt government, meaning the government of Hashim Thaçi, and the parliament is still divided on whether they need a corrupt person like Pakoli? Is that correct?
It's a discussion who is much more corrupted, you know.
As far as I understand, he's got close ties with Russia, his wife is
with
Russian.
Oh,
with everybody?
Yes, with Italy, with European Union.
What does it spell for the future of Kosovo?
When I was last time there, it was several years ago. It looks to me so chaotic, you know. They have a lot of young people, but unemployed.
That's
no
right.
Future. No future, you know. So before they left in Europe as a workers, so we have a big community in Switzerland. In Zurich, we have about 70,000 Albanians from Kosovo. So, you know, they're everywhere all over the world. I spoke with several people because mostly they were students in Zagreb 40 years ago when I was student's leader, you know, saying they, I know more or less everybody of them. What I said to them, the best revenge to you that now your policemen will arrest Kosovo nationalists.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had to protect themselves minority on Kosovo because they are over the pressure from outside. So they had now to arrest their extremists, and of course that extremists will accuse them that they are traitors. So, you know, that's a very interesting situation there, because that was one completely disintegrated country. When I was there last time, some years ago, nobody did not pay electric engine, gas, water, and so on, you know. Now they had to pay everybody, because the West don't want to pay it anymore, you know.
Obviously.
Yes, so now they had to put in order the whole country. You had to pay taxes, you had to pay everything what it's normally in one country. So it's very interesting. So, you know, in economy, you have no long political coalitions, only interests.
If you mentioned the European concerns about Mr. Tachi, how does the situation develop? Was he acquitted, or is it still going on?
No, it's going on. You know, I spoke about that with Cara Del Ponte, because I was very much engaged in war crimes, and my organization, the Croatian Helsinki Committee, was very much engaged in defending of the Serbs in Croatia after the military action storm. So I was in the jail 3 years as an anti-communist and Croatian nationalist. We defend rights of the Serbs in Croatia.
That's right.
Was very important for us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Russians in Russia who are intellectuals had to defend minority rights. That's the only way. You have no other way, you know. And so we know a lot about war crimes. And I met several times Cara Del Ponte and Florence Hartmann. And they spoke to me about that case of Yellow House and that, you know, all story about false transplantation and so on. Now it is investigation of the European institutions. What will be the result? I can't know. Now they arrest in Turkey one man, you know that whole story, who was active in that. So we don't know what will be the real result of that investigations. But that investigations could make a lot of troubles for Kosovo if that investigation will really show that they are the part of mafia. Because then they will lose credibility, and then it will not be a European money. If it will not be European money, you will have a political and economic crisis, like everywhere now. Especially in this situation, when you had 1 month ago demonstrations in Albania against the government, socialist against, what is his name, I can't remember. Because the government which is now in the power, Berisha, they are something like the nationalists, they want big Albania and so on. Socialists want just modern democratic country. So, you know, the background of this case is much more bigger than only are they corrupted or not. It's even politically, because now you have Putin who make a pressure on the Serbian government not to enter to NATO. In the same time, you have a NATO base by Americans 56 kilometers close to Pristina. You have the president of the Western countries there. Then you have pressure on Greece to accept Macedonia in NATO.
Mm-hmm.
They want Bosnia in NATO. They want even Kosovo in NATO. So, you know, it is not only the game between the people on Kosovo. It's even the background. We can't know a lot about this background.
But getting back to Pakoli, like you said, his interests spread all over the, say, Western world, so to say.
Yes.
But what is his business? He's a billionaire. So what is his business? Do you think that it could contribute positively to the situation in Kosovo?
Well, that is the same question which you had to put here even to the politicians in Croatia, Serbia, and so on. What is really your business? That's the problem of Balkans at all. It's even the problem in Russia of many persons.
That's right.
Where from you have this your money? You know, for some persons like Lebedev, like Abramovich, I don't know who, how they earn the money. Well,
we guess.
Okay, more or less, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lot of doubt over that, a big shadow, you know. The problem is that in all ex-communist countries, which you have such a people, we have a money and we don't know the origin of this money.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big problem for all of us. So it's a question of how long it will go on, this transition. Now you have even much more and worse transition in North Africa. It's a question how it will reflect on the stability of Europe, because 1 million people from Libya want to come in Europe. How many people from Egypt will come when they will not have what to eat? A position of Hashim Tachi will not be very easy, because he is personally accused for the corruption. So the first step for Kosovo is normalization with Serbia. I did not think it will go on so easy.
So is there any help coming from outside? I don't mean investment. I mean help from the European
what?
Union, from
yes,
international organizations.
With a declaration and the resolutions of the United Nations, that is not a help. A real help is only to help with the money. Mostly money for the help in Europe is coming from Germany.
So let's hope that Mr. Pakoli's election helps to an extent at least.
Well, he have no big role. He will be like to show to everybody that we have a president of the state. So he have no what to do, really. That's a folklore, more or less. But on a symbolic level, he is something. On symbolic level. And the second, what is very important, he has good connections with Russia. What could help to them very much to stabilize relations with Russia and with Serbia.
Mr. Shishak, thank you very much.
Anyway, with this we end this edition of Red Line, brought to you from the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented to you by me, Sergei Strokin, and Mira Salganik, and Ekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
So long.
Yeah.
So long.
Yeah.
So long.
Yeah.